Cool. Let me start by welcoming you to this session on virtualizing Microsoft Exchange on Hyper-V. Let me start with a big thank you to you guys for all attending. I know this is the last session of the day. Out of the 130 sessions you could have chosen, you chose this one, so I'm absolutely pleased for that. Right. Let me introduce myself. My name's Glenn Gooder. I'm a senior consultant at Microsoft. Last year, I was a BPOS architect, helping people transition to the Microsoft Online Cloud, traveling all around the world, which was quite exciting. Previous to that, I was the messaging architect for the Department of Education, which was 180,000 Exchange mailboxes with 1.3 million students emailing teachers and all sorts of stuff. So it was a very exciting area to be in. And prior to that, I was the infrastructure architect for the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet's APEC Task Force. I don't know if you remember that back in 2007 when we had 21 presidents and prime ministers and all sorts of people coming to this country to do trade negotiations. That was an 80% virtualized infrastructure, and it was highly successful. Now, let me just say, this session is being recorded. If you don't want your voice recorded, then I suggest you don't say anything. But I'm certainly hoping you will do. I was a little disappointed you didn't come a bit closer, because it's actually very hard to hear people in this. I love good interactive sessions, so people feel free to ask questions. If you pushed it all to the back, then one, you've probably forgotten the question anyway. Two, you've lost the context. And three, we might have run out of time, so you might not get to ask it. So feel free to chip in whenever you like. Let's just go through the agenda. So the first topic is, why would you virtualize using Hyper-V? Using the Microsoft applications, so SharePoint, SQL, and Exchange. So to give you a bit of confidence in why you might select the Microsoft Hyper-V, there are a couple of performance results tests that we've got back, one from the virtual reality check team and the other from the enterprise strategy group, where they published their results on what their findings were for Hyper-V performance. And then hopefully you'll feel a bit more confident using Hyper-V, and then we can look at the virtualization best practices for Exchange. Now, primarily, the topic's going to be around Exchange 2010 and why 2010 Service Pack 1 really added a lot of functionality for virtualization. But if you've got questions about previous versions, we can go there too. And finally, there are heaps and heaps of links in this deck. So please, please, please do download the deck and then use the links, because I don't expect you to be scribbling it down right now. Now, we will be asking you for feedback at the end of the session, and there are two ways of giving feedback. The first way is to go and use one of these terminals dotted all around the place, or the other way is you could just get a $50 note and write a suggestion on, and I'll collect the $50 notes at the end of the session. Cool. Why would we want to virtualize on Exchange? First of all, can I have a quick show of hands? Who in here considers themselves a virtualization specialist? Apparently nobody. No? Or one? Okay, who considers themselves Exchange specialists? A few more hands. Cool. So let's just keep that show of hands going. What sort of size environments are you either looking to virtualize or have virtualized on Exchange? Show of hands for 1,000 mailboxes and above. Yeah. 5,000. Cool. 10,000. A bit like a bidding war, isn't it? I think this guy's winning at the moment. So, Exchange as an application is really good at scaling. You know, if you look at TechNet Resources, it's been proven to scale up to 128 gig of RAM. It can go up to 24 cores. In the future, it's going to go 40-plus cores. It is really capable of scaling. So if you're in an environment where you're maybe 50,000 mailboxes, 100,000 mailboxes, 200,000 mailboxes, then virtualization probably doesn't add a whole lot to the piece and maybe adds an extra level of complexity. But generally, if you're below the 50,000 mark, virtualization of Exchange makes a whole lot of sense. And we're going to go through the detail of that in the session today. Just on the subject of feedback, last year I did a session, and I asked for feedback at the end of it, and one guy came up to me and said, "Did you like this session?" And he's like, "No, I didn't like it." And I'm like, "Okay, why didn't you like it?" "Well, the session I wanted to go to was full, so I had to do yours instead." So hopefully, if we've got the right people here, the executive summary is, yes, you can virtualize Exchange. And I won't bore you with the details, but hopefully, if you're still here, you're actually really hungry for the details. Hungry for the details? Peckish? Hungry for dinner? Yes, okay. I'll take that as a yes. So let's have a look at what's happening in the virtualization market and the server sales market. Well, we can see via the yellow bars, you know, server sales are continuing. There's no surprise there. But the thing that is occurring is these servers are getting much, much bigger. In the enterprise strategy group testing, they used 128 gig RAM blades with 24 cores. Anybody got anything that can beat 128 gig of RAM? What sort of sizes have we got in here? 128. Fantastic. Yeah, and what sort of density do you think you can get on that? Fantastic. Yep. So is that a VDI project?
It won't be VDI, it'll be a thin client based on 2X technology.
Cool. Fantastic. So that's a relatively big deployment. I've been speaking to some people, and they've actually got up to half a terabyte in some of their servers. So we're talking some really sizable numbers. And getting 24 cores in a server is pretty easy today. It's going to be 40 cores in the very near future. So what we're seeing is much, much bigger servers being deployed, so you can get much higher VM density on there. Now, in terms of the operating systems that are being virtualized, Windows is still around about the 70% mark. We've got 11% being quite naughty, and the rest are other operating systems. So why would you choose Microsoft Hyper-V for your virtualization? Well, let's have a look at the stack. So from Windows 2008 onwards, you got it in the box. It was there. If you wanted to use it, all you needed to do was do a checkbox, and it was installed. And it's only getting better and better as we go by. So as R2 released, it got better. As Service Pack 1 has been released, we've got a whole bunch of extra functionality now. And the product is only going to get better in Windows Server 2008. Sorry, Server 8. So on top of this really good virtualization engine, you could actually start looking at deploying your Microsoft application workloads. So you could look at deploying Exchange, SharePoint, and SQL on there. And on top of that, you could even look at deploying line of business apps. So there's even some performance measurements that we could look at from Enterprise Service Group about virtualizing SQL and SAP on Hyper-V. Now, the whole story isn't complete until you actually put System Center in there. So it doesn't matter if it's your patch management, if it's your SCOM for monitoring your environment, or Windows Deployment Services, System Center Configuration Manager. This is the whole Microsoft Virtualization Suite. And a lot of people just look at Hyper-V and they just say, well, that doesn't compare to VMware. Well, until you actually put System Center, which is the brain, along to Hyper-V, you're only getting part of the story. The full story is the full System Center suite. So let's have a look at how that story builds. So it's built-in virtualization with one-stop support. If you've got Microsoft providing the hypervisor, you've got them providing the application, and you've got them providing the OS, then the support story there is really good. You've got a large partner ecosystem. So, for example, you've got EMC that are deploying management packs for SCOM to tell them when there are problems with the storage, and so perhaps you could affect movements of VMs based on the changing circumstances. And then you've got deep application knowledge. The people that write the management packs, it's not the System Center Operations Manager team. They're not sitting there scratching their heads wondering what they should be writing here. It's actually the product group that developed the product that writes the management pack. And it really doesn't matter if you're looking at a physical or a virtual deployment. You can use exactly the same agents. And that is actually a really good scenario if you actually currently have physical machines deployed and you decide to virtualize them later on using P2V technologies. And we've got this whole cross-platform support. So with Virtual Machine Manager 2008, you can support ESX and Hyper-V. In 2012, it's also going to support Zen Server. So we've got this big breadth of management platform. And the actual cost of deploying this is actually quite cheap compared to some of the competitors. If you look at System Center Server, keep forgetting the name of the product, System Center Virtual Server Management Data Center Suite, big word there, you can actually license this per processor, and you can actually get a very cost-effective way of managing your whole suite. You get all of the agents on a per-process basis, and you can deploy as much of the System Center Suite as appropriate to you. It's not an all-or-nothing story. Anybody deployed 2008 R2 Service Pack 1 yet for Hyper-V? Yep. So with 2008 R2 Service Pack 1, there were a whole bunch of extra features that came along. There was live migration, and there were HA capabilities. Now, this is kind of an interesting mix when you actually start putting Exchange on top of that. What would the effects of live migration be and using cluster HA availability when you've got things like Exchange DAGs? And later in the session, we'll talk through what the considerations are there. There was new processor support, enhanced scalability. We've got increased density quite considerably, and networking enhancements. New NICs with virtual machine queue are basically optimized for virtual guests. And we've got a lot of dynamic memory capabilities for increasing density, and we've got enhancements to server core. Are people aware what the server core is? So server core was essentially basically a cut-down version of Windows, which basically had the GUI taken out of it, but had all of the engine there. So we've got you can run virtual server in server core, which means it's got a much lower attack surface and therefore doesn't require as much patching, giving it better availability and uptime. Now, dynamic memory, we're going to be covering that in the next slide or two, so I won't go there. And remote FX was for basically VDI implementations. So let's look at dynamic memory, and instead of talking about it, maybe we just show it here. So hopefully in a second that will pop. There you go. So this is basically my Hyper-V server, but this has got Service Pack 1 added. So what we're seeing now is that we've got extra columns, which is assigned memory, memory demand, and memory status. So the difference here being that we've got a synthetic memory driver now into the hypervisor tools. So as the application starts to request more memory, if it's available, the Hyper-V will start granting it more memory. So this is basically perfect for most applications, and particularly VDI, where you've got guest operating systems that might have bursts of memory requirements as they load more applications. Let's have a look at this Windows 7 VM at the moment. As you can see, at the moment, it's been basically assigned 438 meg, and it's only requesting 420. So it's making really efficient use of the memory available on the host. If we look at the way it's configured here, we've got a startup amount of memory of 386 meg and a total maximum amount of memory that it could have as 2 gig. And what you can see here is that you can basically prioritize memory weight. So, for example, if this was your boss's VDI, you might give it high priority. And, you know, if it was somebody you didn't like, you might just punch it down a little bit. But generally, yeah, if resources start becoming constrained, anybody that's listed as high priority will get a chunk of the memory first. So, as I just said, the way it works is you've got this minimum maximum, and as the operating system fluctuates, it can request more memory, and as the memory requirements drop, it gives it back to the operating system. And this is known as basically synthetic memory driver. So, what's different? We talk about overcommitting services. If there's one thing you take away from this session, overcommitment is a bad thing. Me no likey overcommittee, okay? It's a bad thing. That's the one thing you need to remember. A lot of implementations of virtualization really do suffer from the same fundamental problem. They've virtualized 300 servers, and they've put them on, you know, five blades or whatever it turns out to be, but those 300 servers probably had mirrored operating system disks. And those 600 disks that they would have had actually would have been hundreds and hundreds of IOPS. And then they dump it on this SAN with this tiny little LUN and this few disks, and so performance suffers throughout the stack. And then they overcommit the memory, and it gives a really disappointing experience. Overcommitment isn't a good thing. You don't get something for nothing when you virtualize. Okay, quick question. If you had a Hyper-V host and you had 20 VMs on there and it had 20 cores, would you have 20 vCPUs and 20? Is it like for like, is the question? Yes, no? If I've got 20 vCPUs and I've got 20 cores, so I've got one-to-one, is it like for like? No, it isn't. You lose something with the hypervisor layer. And that can be anywhere between 4 and 12% of the CPU capacity, because the hypervisor layer has to do translations. Okay, if you've got 24 gig of RAM, for example, in your server, and you've allocated 24 gig to your guests, is it like for like? No, because there's a memory overhead that the hypervisor layer puts on it. And later in the presentation, we'll go through basically what the formula is to work out what the actual hypervisor needs to be able to provide services. So how does VMware do it? Well, basically, they provide a ballooning service that sits in the guest that basically expands and contracts as memory pressures occur. They also use memory compression and basically page sharing. But page sharing doesn't work particularly well with the new operating systems that use address space randomization layer. This is kind of a Windows defense mechanism for basically attack surfaces that instead of always executing the same block of memory every time an application starts up, it actually moves it around and therefore buffer underrun and overattacks are less likely to occur. So let's have a look at some of the hypervisor results. So these were produced by a group known as Virtual Reality Check. These results are publicly available, so help yourself to do this website. They are kind of a pretty much independent company, though VMware and Citrix has made assisted them with their site. And the results really were based on taking a terminal server workload and comparing it across the platforms. Now, if you think about a terminal server, it's actually a really good example of a workload to look at because it's very memory intensive, you've got lots of connections, and it's a really good indicator of how things scale. So what they discovered in their results was that if you sit Hyper-V on the right platform, you use basically second slat technology or you use the extended page tables in AMD, you could actually get some significant performance results by using Hyper-V on that sort of hardware. So that might affect your purchasing decisions going forward about the type of hardware that you need to buy. So let's be honest. Without hyperthreading, vSphere did perform better than both Zen and Hyper-V. But with hyperthreading enabled, there was some significant performance increases. If you look at this, this was done on x86, so 32 bits environments. And there was very little. vSphere actually did a little bit better. But when you actually start looking at x64 environments with Hyper-V on bare metal, you actually see some significant performance gains from Hyper-V. Now, Enterprise Strategy Group also wrote a paper. Microsoft went to them and said, actually, could you write about your findings on Hyper-V? And the basic points they came back with were Hyper-V is easy to install. It's absolutely tick a box, add it as a role, and it's installed. Anybody had problems installing Hyper-V? I think the hardest thing I've ever found is sometimes having to come to the BIOS to switch on virtualization technology, and that's about as hard as it gets. Hyper-V provides high availability and transparent and automatic failover of virtual machines. Windows 2008 made clustering actually pretty simple. So yeah, absolutely, it's really simple. You've got the capability of live migrations with zero downtime. Anybody know the difference between live migration and quick migration? Sorry? Yeah. Absolutely. So quick migration basically saves the state, dumps all of the memory to disk, moves it over to the next host, and then breeds it all back off the disk. Whereas live migration actually copies block for block memory as the machine is executing. The most important thing here, though, is the performance results. And what they came up with was that you could get almost like-for-like native performance using VHDs of a fixed size. And in terms of the actual CPU, they got results of between 89% and 98% of the physical host. Now, it depends what sort of CPUs you're using and the type of workloads, but you can actually get very similar near-native performance. So this strongly supports that you could actually then start putting big memory-intensive applications like Exchange on top of Hyper-V. Again, there's lots of references there. I encourage you to download this session later and have a look at this report. So just having a look at it in terms of disk IOPS, in the yellow we've got what the native performance would have been like. In the purple, I think you call that, is what the virtualization equivalent is. And you can see that we're actually getting very, very close performance measures. So if you look at the Exchange DB one, which is probably quite of interest here, we got very, very close to what you could actually achieve using a VHD. And here we go, just an extension of that, application installs, directory copies, and so on and so forth. Anybody here use iSCSI instead of Fibre Channel? Yeah, we're getting a few hands. It's really simple. It basically doesn't need the complexity of the Fibre Channel networks. You can probably get rid of the SAN administrator. And it's actually a really good, cheap way of deploying high capacity. Now, if you look to this performance results, this was done round about the launch of the Nehalem chips, the 5500s, 10 gig Ethernet. There's a really good story there about the native performance of the iSCSI stack within Windows 2008 R2. And in their performance test, they managed to get up to 1 million IOPS, which is pretty impressive over a 10 gig Ethernet. And they also did the same test of doing iSCSI within the VM guest, and they actually got some pretty respectable results, 700,000 IOPS. So just having a look at that graphically, this is pretty much near native performance. There was a performance hit, obviously doing it within the guest. You need to make an allowance for that in your design for Exchange, but you can actually get some really good results. A lot of people actually are very impressed with the sort of performance you can get with iSCSI, especially over the 10 gig Ethernet, because you're going to get 8 gig connections on some of the fiber channels. They're obviously getting bigger and better. You look at the Cisco UC Blades, they've got 40 gig connections now. That will soon be up to 100 gig connections. So the performance is just absolutely increasing exponentially. And the takeaway here is really that Hyper-V is not a limiting factor in your I/O considerations, but you do need to factor them into your Exchange design. So let's have a look at the Enterprise Strategy Group results. Again, all available online. Help yourself to these. You're more than welcome to share these with customers or internally. Now, their testing environment looked just like this. Pretty serious piece of kit. It was basically using HP Blaze, 128 gig of RAM, and 24 cores, and that was connected via fiber channel to their EVA SAN. What they were doing was following best practice, which was the operating system should be separated out from the logs and the databases from Exchange. And the type of results that they got, well, they basically put Exchange 2010 Service Pack 1 mailbox, 4 mailbox servers onto that blade. It was running Hyper-V R2 Service Pack, Service Pack 1, and it was using fixed-size VHDs. What they were able to do was linearly scale from 5,000 mailboxes to 20,000 mailboxes. So they basically put 5,000 mailboxes per VM, and yeah, admittedly, the mailbox sizes were a little bit on the small size, 250 megs, not the biggest. What sort of mailbox sizes are we thinking of deploying in this room? 5 gig? Yeah, 5 gig or above? Cool. So they've got IOPS of a moderately loaded server, and they've got 2 database copies. And what they were able to achieve was linear scalability of up to 20,000 mailboxes on a single host using 4 mailbox servers. Now, as you can see, the latency increased only by a minor amount, and it was literally linear scalability. So just looking at it from an IOPS perspective, as they added more mailbox servers with 5,000 mailboxes, increased the IOP load, but performance was still there. Has anybody heard of Exchange-tested solutions? So basically, what it is Microsoft will work with all of the vendors, so F5, EMC, Dell, HP, you name it, And what they will do is come up with a specific tested solution framework. Can't really read it particularly well on that slide, but if you look at the first one, it's basically a 500 mailbox solution on Hyper-V with Dell servers, and it goes all the way down to a 32,000 mailbox solution using Cisco UCS blades. And just graphically representing what the tested solutions look like, they're just presented there. Now, the purpose of the tested solutions, one, it tests the capability of the solution, but what it does is it gives you a tested and validated reference architecture that you could actually go and deploy yourselves. Or it could help you shortcut the design session if there's something similar to what you're actually looking for. So there we go, just a quick synopsis of what those solutions look like. To get up to 32,000 users, they actually span across three sites. They use 96 cores and over a terabyte of RAM. It's pretty serious. And they basically use 432 drives to achieve that. So we're not just talking small solutions. You can actually get some really big virtualized exchange solutions. And like I said, you can download all of those reference architectures if they fit what you're looking for. So what did the results say? We had 20,000 mailboxes on a single HP blade. And we used JetStress to actually create the simulated load of all the users. In reality, would you ever put 20,000 users on a single blade with four mailbox servers? No, you wouldn't, because it would be reducing your overall high availability of Exchange. You would have created that as a database availability group, and you would have spanned it across servers from an availability perspective. The Exchange tested solutions, basically from 9,000 to 32,000 mailboxes. If that fits what you're looking for, you can use those reference architectures. And the 32,000 solution was basically deployed on 36 Hyper-V VMs across three sites. So what this actually tells you is that Hyper-V isn't actually a blocker for actually doing really large-scale virtualized deployments of Exchange 2010. So let's move on now to the Exchange Server virtualization best practices, because by the looks of it, most of people are Exchange people, and this is the bit that's interesting to them. Well, the virtualization story, of course you do it. You know, it's got all of the usual great reasons for doing it. You can consolidate underutilized servers, you can reduce your rack space, you can reduce your cooling, and you can rapidly provision infrastructure. Now, if you look at this really basic solution here, this basically ticks all of the boxes. Any one server could fail from this solution, and you wouldn't lose the service. You can see we've got the client access servers distributed across multiple hosts. We've got the mailbox servers that are in a DAG, basically replicated across multiple hosts. No one server would take down this solution. Now, rather than talk about this slide, I'll just show you. Anybody know about the server virtualization validation program? Just quickly show you this. So basically, if any vendor wants to certify a Microsoft product to say that they can run something in a supported way, you can basically just go to this Windows Server catalog, and you can just put in absolutely any combination that you're looking for, and it will give you the supportability status of the product. So let's choose Exchange 2007. Let's just choose some random ones here. Service Pack 2. And which hypervisor do I want to deploy this on? Any choices? Hyper-V. Okay, let's go with that. And what's the base operating system? 2008? Yeah, we'll stick with 2008. And of course, you couldn't deploy it in production unless it was on x86, 64-bit hardware. And that basically comes back with what the current product support statement is. There you go. So that's actually a really good place if you want to basically assure that you'll get a supported platform. Exchange 2003 is an interesting one there if you do that. So, because it says it's only supported on Virtual Server 2005, so it's going back a little bit there. Obviously, nobody bothered to revalidate it. This is basically the new support stance. This is actually fairly recent. We will go through this point by point, so I won't labor on that now. So what is the best practice for storage in Exchange? Well, you've got the choice. You've got fixed size VHD. The difference between dynamic and fixed size VHD is dynamic is basically pay as you go, whereas fixed VHD is pay up front. So if you deploy a 40 gig VHD file for on your SAN, 40 gig is gone, okay? But the point here is that you'll actually get near native performance because you've got that fixed size disk. Other options include SCSI pass-through. So you've basically got a dedicated SCSI LUN or SCSI disk that you present to the VM guest. Or the other option is iSCSI. Dynamic or thin disks aren't supported in this platform at all, okay? And differencing disks. Now, differencing disk is great for a VDI solution where you might have one gold, you know, Windows 7 image, and then you've got lots of child disks that basically just keep track of the differences. Differencing disks are not supported with an Exchange production deployment. And also, the minimum disk space that you should allocate to your VHD is a bare minimum of 15 gigs plus whatever the size is of the virtual memory you've allocated to that machine. Other considerations. On the actual Hyper-V host itself, you shouldn't install any other software other than possibly antivirus software, the bare minimum that you need. Don't install SQL, don't make it a file server. It should just be a Hyper-V host. VM snapshots aren't supported. So we just had a conversation about live migration versus quick migration. As soon as you basically save the state on a virtual machine, that is no longer a supported virtual machine in a production environment. Let's take an example. Why is that a problem? Say it was a database availability group. It was a mailbox server. You save the state of the disk, and then you maybe fail over, bring it up. So maybe there was, you know, a couple of minutes gap there while it dumped, you know, 128 gig of RAM to disk and then brought it back up. As far as all the other nodes on the cluster were concerned, that node had failed, and it would have effectively evicted it from the cluster. As the machine comes back up, it actually thinks it's still part of that cluster and still tries to service. And that's one reason why that wouldn't be supported. Also, if you look at hub transport servers, if you save the state of those, then potentially they might resend a message when they come back out of the safe state. Because in 2010, you've now got shadow copies. So the shadow copy might have been offloaded to another hub transport server, which thinks it now needs to send the message. Now, oversubscription. Don't oversubscribe. It's going to give you the worst performance experience possible. The ideal is you basically do one for one. You do one core for one virtual CPU. But the maximum that we will support is a 2-to-1 oversubscription ratio. Try not to do it if you can avoid it at all. And dynamic memory, we looked at it earlier. Dynamic memory is a great thing in VDI, maybe in file servers, things that could actually burst and fluctuate in memory. But for an Exchange 2010 point of view, that is a complete no-no. There is a reason why Exchange gobbles all of the memory it possibly can. And the reason for that is because it's trying to minimize the amount of I/O that you put on the disk. That's why Exchange 2010 can actually go on the lowest grade disks that you could possibly imagine, like 2 terabyte SATA drives, you know, with 50 random IOPS. It's basically they've offset disk I/O performance with memory. The assumption is that you'll get better performance in memory than you will on disk. So the whole solution was engineered around the fact that you want to do as many sequential reads as possible and do as little reads as possible and as minimal number of writes as possible too. So what would happen if you use dynamic memory on a production Exchange server? So the server gets a bit busy and it decides to start taking away memory from the Exchange server. Well, Exchange isn't virtualization aware. It's not expecting it. So what it's going to do is start hitting the disks a lot more, and the performance is just going to drop substantially. Like I said, Exchange is not virtualization aware. The only part of Exchange 2010 that is virtualization aware is the best practices analyzer. And that's only aware just so they can report it. There are no other components within Exchange as it stands today that basically knows it's sitting on VMware or Hyper-V or anything. So basically, if it was, for example, trying to send a message to a hub transport server and you've got all of your hub transport servers on the same host and that fails, Exchange doesn't know that. It's not going to talk to another hub transport server in a different site. It doesn't know that you've got them all on a single point of failure. So the core design principles with Exchange 2010 is always designed for performance. Performance. What makes Exchange perform? It's CPU, it's memory, it's disk. Then design for reliability. How many copies do you need in your database availability group? Do you need one? Do you need four? Do you need 16? So whatever the reasons that drove those decisions, always design as if you were designing for physical first. Same goes for usage profiles on your CAS and your hub. Use the Exchange Profile Analyzer to look at the sort of traffic that you send, the number of connections that you get, and basically what your messaging system is doing. And then you can actually start to move on to the virtualization environment. Always start with the physical first, but nothing changes. You've still got to design your Hyper-V for performance, reliability, and capacity. There's no point in designing a mailbox server that needs 32 gig of RAM if you're only going to deploy 16 gig Hyper-V servers, because instantly you've got oversubscription there and you're going to take a performance hit as a result of that. So your host should always be well-sized for your guests, especially if you're planning on doing live migrations. Say, for example, you had two 32 gig mailbox servers and you decided to live migrate while you did some maintenance, but the host only had 48 gig. Straight away, you're into a performance issue. Exchange isn't expecting the loss of memory, and it's going to start paging really heavily. So let's have a look at the best practices for capacity and sizing. So start with a physical server. There are some great tools out there. Anybody know the Exchange role requirements calculator? Yep, it's at version 17.2 now. It's looking really good, actually. You can even simulate failover conditions and whether or not you'd lose quorum within Exchange. The best part about the Exchange role calculator, apart from telling you what you need, is that it would also spit out scripts for formatting all of your disks and for creating your databases. Account for the virtualization overhead. As I said, one core is not the same as one vCPU. You've got a virtualization overhead there, and depending on the type of hypervisor you're using and the type of hardware that you're using, you're going to see a performance hit of between 2 and 12%. In the Exchange role calculator, when you tick the virtualization box, is it doing anything amazing? No, all it's doing is adding 10% to your CPU requirements to cater for the virtualization overhead. Now, if your hypervisor vendor says you can do this with 4%, that's fine. They know best for their particular piece of hardware. But as a conservative estimate, the role calculator will always allow a 10% performance hit on the hypervisor. Now, size your root servers for storage and network infrastructure. It's extremely important. And I think we'll come back to some details about that in a little while. Always size the mailbox role first. The mailbox role is the most complicated, but once you've sized it correctly, all of the others just fit into place. All of the advice around the building in a 2010 design is on about basically a CPU ratio. So, for example, for every four mailbox server CPUs or cores you've got, you need to allow for three client access server cores. It's all about ratios here. And remember that designing for high availability will significantly impact your sizing design. If you suddenly decide you want four copies of each of your databases, you've got to allow for four copies of each of your databases, which will affect your storage design and the complexity. If you look at how Exchange has grown over the years, Exchange 2003 allowed you to do 20 databases. 2007 allowed you to go to 50 databases. Exchange 2010 allows you to go to 100 databases. And when you pair them with a database availability group, you can have 2 terabyte databases. So potentially, you could be looking at 200 terabytes of Exchange data on a single server. And if you're putting that into a high availability design, you're going to need to replicate that. Don't forget the network needs. Exchange needs a mapping connection, and it also needs a replication connection, ideally. But then when you overlay that with what the hypervisor needs, you can actually have quite a significant number of network connections required. Don't oversubscribe resources. You'll hear that a few times in this session. The unified messaging role, that is now supported on a virtualized environment. This is new to Service Pack 1, 2010 Service Pack 1. Has anybody deployed that yet? No? Which version are we on? 2007, looking to migrate, or... Quick show of hands, 2003 to, yep, and looking to migrate to 2010? Cool. Okay, so the unified messaging role basically allows you to store voicemails in your inbox. This is now supported in 2010 Service Pack 1. Basically, the Exchange team did a bunch of work with the Link team. They changed their codecs. They've got some stuff right, and now they're in a position where they can support the unified messaging role. Now, the minimum requirements for the unified messaging role are 4 virtual CPUs, which just happens to be the maximum you can install on a Hyper-V guest. And you've got to bear in mind that it is extremely sensitive to network latency. So things like live migrations, or basically running SIP trunks over long distances, could impact the quality of the call. It is very important that you do not oversubscribe your CPUs if you're going to do the virtualization role. It is CPU intensive, and 4 virtual CPUs with 16 gig of RAM can basically handle between 40 to 65 calls if you're not doing message preview. So let's talk about the root server sizing. So the root server basically needs quite a number of NICs. How many NICs would you need? If you're using a fiber channel implementation, you would use 6 NICs plus 2 HBAs going to your fiber channel network. Or if you're using iSCSI, you'd need a minimum of 8 NICs. I'm not going to try and remember what the 8 are for, so I'm going to go back to my notes. So the first NIC that you require is your management NIC. So basically the system center agents can talk to the server. Then you'll need a live migration NIC. Now this is really important. If you start to think about the scale of these servers, you're talking maybe 128 gig RAM plus, and that is a lot of blocks to basically move between two servers. So you don't want that traffic to be mixed with anything else. You want your cluster heartbeat NICs to be dedicated, so that they can basically, all of the nodes will know that the cluster is still alive and healthy and won't try and do failover conditions. And if you're using cluster shared volumes, you'll need a dedicated cluster shared volume NIC. Anybody know cluster shared volumes? Yeah. So basically with the latest version of Hyper-V, cluster shared volumes, you can have multiple cluster host nodes accessing the same LUN at the same time. So it's basically aware, it basically won't do write contention. So what you can actually do with cluster shared volumes is you can get extremely fast failover times. So the idea with the cluster shared volume NIC, though, is that should this host lose connectivity to the storage, it can basically redirect over the cluster shared volume NIC to a node that can still access the storage. Now, if you're using iSCSI, you'll need 2 NICs for that from a performance point of view and for a redundancy point of view. And then you'll probably need at least 2 NICs for your virtual machines because they could be creating high levels of traffic. In an exchange scenario, you might have one of those NICs dedicated to MAPI traffic and another one dedicated to replication traffic for database reseeds. So that gives you 8 NICs. It's quite a lot. And perhaps you might want to consider adding redundancy or teaming. So that could actually size up the number of NICs quite significantly. So CPU sizing. There's basically some formula that you need to use here with CPU sizing. You know that basically one core does not equal one vCPU because there's CPU overhead. So allow for that in your solution. But there's also a memory overhead, and if anybody's any good at maths, they've probably already worked this out. I'm not so good. But in this example, if you've got 8 virtual machines, each running with 32 gig of RAM, then the amount of overhead that you have to give to the hypervisor is basically 2.2 gigs of RAM. Okay, so you need to factor this into your root server sizing. Virtual processors. If you've got the choice, would you deploy 4 1 CPU Exchange Mailboxes servers, or would you deploy 1 4 vCPU servers? For the biggest one possible, you'd basically put 4 vCPUs on the server because Exchange is designed to use as many cores as it can get. It's basically, at the moment, it can scale to 24 cores. So the more cores that you can give it, the better. And once again, don't oversubscribe your CPUs. You hear this a few times in this session. And although you can generally assume that one logical CPU is one virtual CPU, it's not 100% accurate. And don't assume for one moment that hyperthreading is the equivalent of an extra CPU or a core. So server deployment, best practices. VMware placement is very important for high availability. Don't look at putting all of your DAG mailbox members on the same host because you're minimizing your high availability solution. Exchange, as I said, is unaware of the fact that it's virtualized, and it doesn't actually know the location of the VMs within the hosts. So it doesn't know if it's choosing a good hub transport server or not. It doesn't know if it's trying to... If for example, you had an Exchange with all of the roles, so it was multi-roled, natively, Exchange would select a different hub transport server to itself. But if that hub transport server tended to be on the same host, it wouldn't know that. So for stuff like shadow copying, shadow redundancy, you might not actually get any better performance gains there. And basically, design for your peak workloads. If 9 o'clock in the morning is your busy time, then design for that, especially if you're looking at doing vMotions across servers. So when it comes to storage decisions, you've basically got a few options to go for. You either look at fixed-size VHD, you can look at fiber channel, you can look at iSCSI fiber channel over Ethernet. What decision do you make there around about what solution is right for you? And the general advice here is design for the simplest solution that will scale to large mailboxes. As people said, they're looking probably for 5 and 10 gig mailboxes moving forward. Do this in the cheapest way possible. The Exchange was designed for low-end storage. You know, you don't have to have 15K fiber channel disks spinning around when you don't necessarily need them. You just need to plan your disk strategy very well. A fixed-size VHDs, if you go there on cluster-shared volumes, is a great way to go as well, just as well as using iSCSI within the Exchange guest. Just a quick question out of interest. Is anybody looking at deploying direct attached storage for their database availability groups? You? It's kind of been a very kind of mixed received thing. All of the product group are saying, keep it simple, use the cheapest disks possible. But every SAN administrator that I've ever spoken to with 2010 designs are pretty reluctant to have direct attached storage put in their data center. And unfortunately, they seem to carry a lot of weight. But you can get some excellent performance from Exchange on direct attached storage using 2 terabyte SATA drives, especially if you've got sufficient memory to allow caching to occur. So a bit of advice here. If you are planning to look at doing live migrations of your virtualized Exchange guests, the best way to go is fixed disk on VHD cluster shared volumes. And the reason for that is if you think as this scales, you know, potentially you could go up to 100 databases, which could be up to 200 LUNs. If you did this with SCSI pass-through disks and you decided to vMotion, assuming that you could present the same storage after you've vMotioned, you've got to actually basically flush all of the caches to those SCSI disks. You've got to then release that SCSI reservation. And that can actually take a period of time when you've got quite a lot of them. And potentially, you could get into a situation where actually the database availability group thinks a timeout has occurred and that node has failed because it hasn't been able to free up and then reallocate the disks quickly enough. Now, CSV and fixed VHTs get around that problem. Now, as I keep saying, Internet iSCSI, it's definitely an option. It's getting more and more popular as 10 gig Ethernet is becoming more and more common. And there are certain optimizations you can do. Let me just quickly show you a couple of things. Now, the absolute first thing you should do if you're interested in putting iSCSI into the guest is basically ensure you haven't got a legacy NIC in place. You need to have the latest, greatest NIC on the VM guest. And then what you'll see within the NIC driver is that it will allow you to basically start using jumbo frames for iSCSI. So basically up to 9K frames. Now, make sure that every part of your network supports this. Cisco switches will go up to 9K, but they do need to be configured for large, basically jumbo frames. Then once you've got that working, you can basically just start the iSCSI target, or the iSCSI software, and connect to your target. First thing it will ask you to do is, do you want to start the service? And it will open up the firewall ports if you've got the firewall running. And then you're basically, away you go, you're ready to start configuring your access to the iSCSI target. Okay, Exchange does not support network-attached storage. So if you've got a NAS that can present as iSCSI, but the underlying storage is basically file-based, that is not a supported platform. It needs block-level access to disks. Okay. Now, Exchange isn't a sysprep-friendly application. Big shame. You can't install an Exchange server, sysprep it, then clone the image, and then spit it out 20 times. But what you can do is basically take your VM template, put the Exchange binaries into it, into the image, and then when you sysprep the image and deploy it, you can basically have run one scripts that could then basically start doing the Exchange install. So, for example, if you were clever enough to write a script that looked at the host name, that said CAS in it, for example, it would know to basically call and install as a client access server. So that's definitely one option that you've got for building star images and getting rapid deployment of Exchange that way. So best practices for high availability and VM migration. So let's first of all start with a definition. What does the Exchange product group consider Exchange high availability? And high availability, by their definition, is that you've got the servers located in the same data center and that the primary active manager can keep in touch with all of those. It can see the status of all of the servers so it can make the right selection when it does failover. So it knows how many logs haven't been committed, how many more it's got to replicate, whether it's crawling through catalogs and so on and so forth. And basically, it will do the automatic activation of the best database available to continue servicing clients. Now, the definition for disaster recovery, therefore, is it's a manual activation. And the reason for that is that generally you've lost quorum within your database availability group, and there are potentially scenarios where you're activating a disaster recovery site. It might not have been able to keep up with the replication traffic, and therefore there might be some data loss scenarios, or you're potentially into a split brain scenario. So disaster recovery is always considered a manual activation process by the product group. So let's just talk a little bit about database availability groups. Yep, it's fundamentally built on Windows clustering. Windows clustering allows you to have 16 nodes in a cluster, which basically means you can replicate databases up to 16 times. Haven't found anybody yet that wants to replicate 16 times, but somewhere between 3 and 4 seems to be a good story right now. And what it does is basically use continuous log replication to basically replicate transaction logs to the other node in the database availability group. Now, one thing that did change with Service Pack 1 here is that if the network performance is sufficient, it won't wait for the transaction log to be finished and closed. It will actually do block-level replication of that log, so you won't even miss any transactions whatsoever. Now, this is completely dependent on the network capacity that you've got between the two locations, and it's also dependent on the hardware capabilities. If the server can keep up, it will basically work in a block-level mode. Now, the great thing about database availability groups, which is just so much better than Exchange 2007, was that it's actually really easy to stretch database availability groups across sites. You could do it with Exchange 2000 and CCR clusters, but it was painful, and DNS failover took a long time. So whilst it was achievable, you really looked at having to write a custom script, so when the node failed over, it would push updates out to DNS servers to basically make it a fast failover experience. Database availability groups don't have that DNS requirement. They basically use the primary active manager to determine where it should be looking for the database copy. And it is a much simpler, painless way of doing it. So what are the native data protection benefits of Exchange? Well, for example, you've got protection at the database level, the server level, and the network level. You've also got automatic failover protection and manual switchover control. And you can have up to 16 copies, some of which that could be lagged. The whole point of lagging is that potentially you could get around corruption scenarios. You could lag a database by, say, 24 hours. Maybe you're doing a service pack update or a virus, for example, got in, although that hasn't happened for years and years. You could actually just basically play back the logs up to the point of the problem and then continue from that point onwards. So if you compare that native protection with what Hyper-V would give you, would you rather have two mailbox servers in a database availability group, or would you rather have one server basically highly available using Hyper-V? And it's actually a fairly simple answer. You would basically have two mailbox servers in a database availability group. And there are reasons for this. For example, if you're using low-end storage, low-end storage such as 2 terabyte SATA disks. Now, one of the problems with low-end storage is that over time, as the disk gets near failure, you'll start getting bit error rates occurring. Now, what Exchange can do in 2010 is if it detects a corrupt page, it can actually send a request to any other member in the database availability group saying, I've got a corrupt page here. Could you please re-replicate that page back to me? And basically, it will recover at the page level. Now, if you only had one Exchange mailbox server and you were doing high availability just using native clustering of Hyper-V, you wouldn't have any point of reference to recover. And if it was a failed service pack, for example, then you've still got a service outage, because if the service is down, the service is down. Failing it over to a different node will make no difference whatsoever. But let's compare that to host-based failover clustering. There are definite benefits of where you might want to use it. For example, if you're going into a maintenance window and you actually want to take the host down, that would be an example of where host-based with live migration would actually be a really good story. Now, bear in mind, though, that Hyper-V is not Exchange-aware, just as Exchange is not Hyper-V-aware. So if you put all of your mailbox servers together on the same host, it doesn't know about that. If all of your hub transports are on the same host, it doesn't necessarily know that that's Exchange and that that server failing could actually give an outage. So basically, you want to start putting rules together that don't allow the same types of service to sit on the same hosts. And bearing in mind that the trend is for larger mailboxes, we're talking 10 gig mailboxes at the moment. If you only had a single host, a single mailbox guest, and you had to do a restore of that from tape, that would be a massive outage. So basically, take the benefits of basically Hyper-V clustering and live migration, but pair them up with the native built-in fault tolerance of Exchange. You can get far faster failover of a DAG group in Exchange than you could be by basically a host failing and bringing up the guest on another node. So VMware migrations, physical computer maintenance, that's absolutely a justifiable reason. You might actually elect during maintenance windows to reduce your level of availability. That's perfectly fine in those scenarios where you're making a conscious choice that you want to reduce your capability. Another thing is you might want to dynamically redistribute your VMs to optimize the actual use of the hardware. Now, create rules to make sure that you're always separating the same types of services. It's also possible that you might want green IT, and you might actually want to start shutting down your hosts at a certain point of the night, say midnight till 6 a.m. You might want to reduce the number of hosts that are running. And there, you might actually elect to take the hit on availability to consolidate your power and basically do your bit for the group of the world. So, how can you minimize the outage during VM migrations? The strong recommendation here is consider cluster shared volumes rather than pass-through LUNs, because the blackout window is much, much smaller. Disable migration technologies that save state. Exchange must always be going forward in time, because otherwise it will start behaving strangely. As I said earlier, if you save the state of a database availability group member and then you brought it back up, it would think that it's still part of an active database and start servicing databases, whereas all of the other nodes would think that it's gone offline and that actually it should have failed over. Now, one thing that you might want to consider doing also is relaxing the cluster heartbeat interval, because by default in Exchange 2010, if a node doesn't respond within 5 seconds, it's considered as failed. In pretty much every safe state scenario you will get into, you will probably not be able to bring up that guest within less than 5 seconds. It will consider it down. And be aware of the additional network interfaces required for these technologies. You need Exchange replication. Okay, how many NICs do you need if you're using iSCSI on a Hyper-V? What's the minimum number of NICs? 8, absolutely. So definitely consider that when you're planning for exchange and when you're planning for your replication networks. So coexistence with other workloads. Well, as we've said, Exchange is pretty memory hungry, and there is a very good reason why it's memory hungry, and it's so it can go on slower, cheaper disks. It's not really optimized for dynamic memory. It's not really designed for shifting workloads. So maybe you should consider it more of as an allocated, dedicated capacity rather than trying to mix workloads with it. So key takeaways, disable dynamic memory. Exchange won't love you for it. Bad things happen when you disable enable dynamic memory. If you've got any sort of storage automatic tuning, disable that as well. Exchange expects a certain amount of performance from its disks. If the disk I/O is underperforming, then you've probably got too many things going on the LUN, or you haven't done your disk storage calculations correctly. The more memory you give Exchange, the less IOPS it generates, because the more preemptive stuff that it caches. So absolutely switch off all of the dynamic settings altogether. So how can you enhance the story of Exchange on Hyper-V? And as I said earlier, System Center is the way to go. Data Protection Manager is capable of doing snapshots every 15 minutes of Exchange databases. And because we give the licenses away for free, you can have server backup servers all over the place. And you can actually replicate Exchange data between the servers. It'll be block-level replication, so it's actually fairly minimal. So you could have DPM to DPM, basically, in a DR site. Another thing that we've got is Operations Manager. If something's going bad in your environment, do you want to spend your night looking through event logs, trying to work out what's going wrong? No, you want the management pack for Hyper-V and for Exchange, so it can make informed decisions about what's going on in the environment and make recommendations for how you can remediate. And likewise, System Center Virtual Machine Manager 2008 basically builds in all of the intelligence to Hyper-V that allows you to do the live migrations. Let me just give you another quick demo here. So this is coming from Sydney, so hopefully the network connection will remain stable. What's the first thing you notice about this? Assuming you can see it, because you're pretty far back. The mouse gives it away. So the first thing that you notice is in the storage, I've used almost half a terabyte, but I've committed 2 terabytes. Instantly, that says that I'm using dynamic disks. And therefore, that wouldn't be a supported configuration. Exchange, to get the performance, you need to have fixed-size disks. Now, say you're a Hyper-V administrator. You want the Exchange team to look after their Exchange stuff. You want them to be able to provision their own services. So this is VMM 2012, and this is a beta. You might want to create them their own piece of cloud capacity. So, you know, this might be the Exchange cloud. You want them to have their own little bit of dedicated private cloud. And so you can allocate them specific hosts so that they've got dedicated capacity for Exchange. Maybe you've allocated them four hosts, for example. You've created a group of that, and so the team now can create VMs within that groups. The next thing is you'd want to allocate them logical networks. So in this case, I've just allocated them a lab network. And just about every installation of Exchange requires a load balancer. So in this case, I've got a Citrix NetScaler, so I'm going to allocate that to the private cloud. And because NetScaler is Exchange aware, I can actually then allocate it to Exchange-specific VIPs. Now, if I had some expensive storage, I could have had a plug-in there which would have given them specific amounts of storage and management. And I might want to give them a library of the images that I've given them so that they can deploy their VMs. Now, this is the really important bit here. You can actually specify how much capacity from the cloud you're going to allow them to have. You know, perhaps they can only deploy 20 VMs, and perhaps they can only, say, 20 vCPUs. And you can allocate them a certain amount of quota points. So within your templates, you can say how much each type of template guest consumes. And likewise, you can allocate them a set amount of disk. So you can say, perhaps maybe they only have, a terabyte of storage. That would be a bit mean, but example. And you can allocate them a fixed amount of memory from the total amount of memory available within those hosts that I've selected. So, maybe you just wanted to give them 32 gigs. Completely plausible. And away you go. You can specify whether you want those guests that can be running on Hyper-V or ESX or Zen Server, because this is VMM 2012. And there you go. You've just created the Exchange team a cloud with some dedicated capacity for which they can start building their virtualized environment on. So a lot of the vendors now, F5, for example, and Citrix, they're now bringing out load balancers that basically work on Hyper-V. So they can easily be deployed through SCVMM. SCVMM 2012 understands Citrix. It's an add-on pack that you can simply deploy, just as you saw in the example there. Citrix NetScaler basically comes with predefined templates for Exchange 2010. So it's pretty much wizard, next. This is the type of VIPs I want. These are the hosts they'll be connecting to. And one of the great things about the Citrix NetScaler is that it ships with a pro management pack. So if it starts detecting problems in the environment, maybe something's getting overloaded, it can actually send out updates via SCOM to VMM to notify that maybe it should move some VMs around. So partner evidence. HP, they've got a 20,000 user, half a gig mailboxes. They've got a reference architecture. So if that kind of fits what you're looking for, please do take a look at this link. Likewise, they've got a 5,000 user, 256 meg mailbox solution as well. So let's just quickly summarize what we talked about. Hopefully, you've got more confidence now in why you'd actually choose Hyper-V to virtualize your applications such as Exchange, SQL, or SharePoint. Why Hyper-V? We've seen the extra features that are available in R2 Service Pack 1. The product is just getting better and better. And we've looked at a couple of performance results. We looked at the Enterprise Strategy Group with their performance testing. We also looked at the virtual reality check results. And we looked at some of the best practices for virtualizing Exchange. And the surrounding ecosystem, we've got F5 that integrate. We've got EMC with their storage that integrates into SCOM. We've got HP. And we've got lots of reference architectures that can basically shortcut your design processes. And there are absolute heap of resources in this session, so please download it afterwards. There are more detailed sessions coming up. There were some great ones earlier today. If you missed them, please look at the recordings. They'll be available in the next day or two. There are some great detailed sessions tomorrow, so please do look at further details, where they'll look at the tools in much more detail than I could do here. Any questions? Good question. I'm not sure specifically on the Citrix side of things, but I guess if Citrix are releasing this as a product, so I don't see why that wouldn't be supported by them. Okay. Well, did we finish early? Yes, you've got a whole 6 minutes of your life back. Unless there's any more questions, I'd like to thank you very much for attending today. Thank you.